Well, first of all, I owe thanks to Clive. I want to thank him for inviting me to participate in this very important conference. And I found the discussions, each and every one of them, very informative and very stimulating. At the same time, I owe Clive an apology because he asked me to talk about terrorist financing and charities. And you can see from the title of my paper, I'm focusing on banks. Yeah. And so, in my defense, Clive, there were two very significant terrorist financing related events that occurred last week in the United States. And the first of those two events was a federal jury in New York found the Arab Bank liable for violating the Anti-Terrorism Act of the U.S. That case is a landmark case because it's the first time in the history of that legislation that a bank has been held liable for violating the provisions of the Act. Even though, by the way, the Act was passed by Congress in 1990. And so here we are in 2014 and we have the first case. And the commentators, in response to that verdict, which occurred a week ago, Monday, were quite profuse in their praise for the verdict and claiming that it basically sounded the death knell for other banks in the United States that have been sued under the ATA. And I tend to disagree with that assessment of the Arab Bank case. Second important event that occurred last week was the day following, I think it was the Tuesday or the day after, that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York decided a case involving Weiss versus National Westminster Bank, NatWest Bank, and of course that's a British-based bank. And the Second Circuit reversed the district court decision, which had dismissed the allegations against the bank and reinstated the allegations again under the Anti-Terrorism Act. And so the bank now has to defend against those allegations. And again, in my defense, I didn't completely disregard my assignment because I do think that the ATA is not limited solely to banks, but it has equal application to charities. In fact, there's one very important case in the United States, Boehm versus the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development. And in that case, the charity HLF was sued by the Boehm family for violating the ATA. And Boehm was a young man, a teenager, who was studying in Israel. And he was a victim of a terrorist attack. A terrorist attack. It wasn't a suicide bomb, but a terrorist attack that took his life, and his family sued Holy Land Foundation, the Quranic Literacy Institute, and a couple of other charities for violations of the ATA. So I think that the topic is not only relevant, but I think it's particularly timely. And the thesis of my paper is this, that the and we've talked about successes and failures, and in this particular case, I think it's an example of a failure. And my thesis is the failure of the Anti-Terrorism Act to provide a meaningful remedy to victims of international terrorism. And that's the thesis that I defend in the paper that I've been working on. And it's very much a work in progress, and so I would very much appreciate and encourage any comments that you have on the talk and my views regarding the ATA. But let me begin to make the case for my thesis. This is the Anti-Terrorism Act, and I don't know, by the way, if there is a UK or a Canadian or an Italian or an Australian counterpart to this. But it's a statute that was passed by Congress that authorizes a private cause of action. And up to now, everything we've been talking about is government action. Whether it's government action in terms of criminal prosecution or economic sanctions, Bank Secrecy Act regulations and such, well, this is different. This is a private cause of action. It's a tort action. And basically, it authorizes treble damages. So it's not simply compensatory, but it's punitive. So whatever the damages that are assessed by the court, the plaintiff is entitled to three times those damages and court costs and attorney's fees. So you can imagine there's a real incentive for plaintiffs to bring a cause of action, under this, because all their attorney fees are going to be paid by the loser, and they're going to get treble damages, and they're going to take these cases on retainer, and conceivably they're going to make a ton of money. Here's the statute, you know, and this is it. Okay, this is the entirety of it. There's a definitional statute that I'll get into, but it provides, any national of the United States injured his or her person, property, or business by reason of an act of international terrorism, or his or her estate, survivors, heirs, etc., may sue, therefore, in any appropriate district court of the U.S. and shall recover threefold damages. He or she sustains the cost of the suit, attorney's fees. Okay. A couple of things. You know, first of all, it's limited to U.S. nationals. Only U.S. nationals can sue. So foreign nationals are not afforded a cause of action under this provision. And there are a couple of other important aspects of the statute. First, it must be by reason of, you know, the injury must be by reason of an act of international terrorism. So the term international terrorism is a term of art, and it's defined in the next statute that I'm going to show you. And it's a rather complicated and somewhat convoluted definition of international terrorism. And then further, it has to be by reason of that the injury has to be by reason of that. And the courts have consistently interpreted that language, by reason of, to impose a proximate cause requirement. So the act of international terror must be the proximate cause of the injury suffered by the U.S. National victim. One other thing that you may have already observed from looking at the statute, and I'm going to go into it in some detail, and that is, what's the scienter? What's the mens rea requirement under the statute? There is none. You know, Congress omitted, and did so intentionally, any scienter requirement. That doesn't mean there is none. But what they did, and this is proven out through the legislative history, is they basically say, we're going to take a common law approach, kind of a traditional common law approach, and we're going to leave it to the courts to define the contours of the statute, which I think is a big mistake. Because once you do that, you leave it to the courts, guess what's going to happen? And the courts are going to be in disagreement as to what the mens rea requirement is. And that's exactly what has happened, and I'll highlight that through a couple of cases. So you've got one jurisdiction saying, oh, the mens rea is this, all you have to prove is knowledge. Then you've got another jurisdiction saying, no, the mens rea, the scienter, is both knowledge and then intent. And so depending upon which jurisdiction the civil cause of action is brought, you could conceivably have disparate results, where a certain individual is found not liable, because you only have to prove, or found liable because you only have to prove knowledge, but in the jurisdiction next door, he's found not liable because you have to prove knowledge and intent. And clearly, for lawyers, that's just an untenable result, right? I mean, we can't have the law being applied inconsistently, disparately, dependent solely upon the location, you know, where the cause of action is filed. So that's a problem. And then the other interesting aspect of this, when you look at the legislative history, is the legislative history is fairly clear that Congress intended this private cause of action to provide a remedy for victims of terrorism so that they could deter terrorist attacks by suing the terrorists, and that would deter them. And they would hit the terrorists where it hurts them the most through these treble damages, and that would hit them in the pocketbook. Well, to me, I'm not sure that goal, that objective is realistic, because first and foremost, I don't think there's too many foreign terrorists that are going to have assets in the United States that can be attached to enforce a judgment, right? And I further don't think that the terrorist organization, you know, the FTO, the Foreign Terrorist Organization, is going to have assets located in the United States that can be attached to enforce an ATA judgment. And further, and maybe this, you know, varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but I don't think that the foreign states have a legal obligation to enforce a civil domestic judgment in the United States. So if the plaintiffs, you know, went abroad, they went to Jordan, for example, and they said, well, you know, the terrorist organization has assets in Jordan, and we want to attach those assets, and we want the Jordanian judge to enforce the U.S. domestic civil judgment, I think probably the foreign court would say, you know, forget it. We don't have an obligation to do it, and there's no legal authority for doing it, and we're not. And so, guess who's being sued? under the ATA. You know, it's not the terrorists, it's not the terrorist organizations, it's the secondary actors. It's the charities and the banks under a theory that they aided and abetted the act of international terrorism through the provision of finances, raising money for the terrorist organization, Hamas, for example, in the case of the Holy Land Foundation, or the bank, in the case of NatWest Bank, provided financial services to Interpol, a charity that was providing, raising money for Hamas. So we're going to go after the secondary actors because the primary actors don't have any money that we can attach. And the problem that I see with respect to that theory, and it's a viable theory, is that I don't see anything in the text of the statute that authorizes aiding and abetting. Congress is silent. The statute is silent on whether or not the statute authorizes recovery under a theory of aiding and abetting. And as a result, going back to, you know, legislative history, we're going to let the courts sort it out. The courts have inconsistently construed whether the statute with respect to whether or not aiding and abetting is authorized. And the Second Circuit in New York, the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, I mean, there are other states that are covered within these jurisdictions, but they're two very important circuit courts in the United States, have concluded that the ATA does not authorize a theory of aiding and abetting. But the majority of jurisdictions have concluded otherwise. So here's another instance where we have a split in the circuits. So if you go into if you file an ATA claim in New York, you have to prove that the charity or that the bank is directly responsible, that its service, the provision of financial services was the proximate cause of the injury. And how are you going to do that? We know that the proximate cause was the terrorists that detonated the bomb, that ignited the suicide vest that killed the victims. It wasn't the bank. I mean, the bank may have had some role, but it wasn't the direct cause. And the charity may have had some role, but it wasn't the direct cause. So again, we have this statute that's being applied inconsistently, dependent upon which jurisdiction it's filed. Okay, international terrorism, of course, that's a critical issue. It's a critical element because the injury has to be by reason of an act of international terrorism. So the statute defines the term international terrorism, and it has three important components. First is that the act or acts must involve acts, violent acts or acts dangerous to human life. That are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States. Okay? So that's the first. And because, again, I have limited time, I'm just going to jump ahead. So what does that have to do with banks? You know, how could a bank be involved in the commission of international terrorism? What violent act did it commit? Or what act dangerous to human life did the bank commit or the charity? Well, the courts have taken a criminal statute called the material support statute that makes it a crime to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. And the term material support is a term of art. It includes a long list of activities that are considered to constitute material support. And one of those forms of material support includes currency. So if you give money to an FBO, that's material support. Another term under the definition of material support is financial services. So if you give financial services to an FTO, foreign terrorist organization, that constitutes material support. So the courts have basically said that if you give financial services to an FTO and you violate the material support statute, you have committed acts dangerous to human life. Giving money to an FTO is an act dangerous to human life. Giving financial services to an FTO is an act dangerous to human life. So that's they backdoor. That's how they get into holding a bank or a charity liable. Second important element is that the act of international terrorism must appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of a government by assassination or kidnapping. Okay. Now, we're familiar with these latter terms, you know, intimidate or coerce a civilian population. I mean, that's really kind of classic definition of international terrorism, right? That's what distinguishes an act of international terrorism from a violent crime, from a merely violent crime. And what's interesting here is the statute doesn't say that the defendant must have intended that. And if you read this closely, as lawyers do, and this is our job to interpret statutes, the statute says it appears to be intended. So the defendant's conduct appears to be intended. There's an external appearance, not an actual intent. And so that has become a problem with respect to banks and whether or not the provision of financial services to Interpol, the provision of financial services to the Holy Land Foundation, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce the civilian population. And of course the bank, NatWest Bank, is going to say, that wasn't our intent. Our intent was to make a profit. We didn't intend to influence or coerce any civilian population. We didn't intend to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. We just intended to make some money. And so this becomes a real problem for plaintiffs. How do they prove? What evidence is probative of whether or not the external appearance of the bank's conduct appears to be intended, you know, to influence and so forth? And then lastly, and this is actually a fairly easy element of the definition of international terrorism to meet, and that is basically there's a transnational extraterritorial element to the acts. They occur primarily outside of the United States, or they transcend national boundaries in terms of. Okay. So I've only got a couple of minutes left. So here, by the way, is the material support statute. And so here's what it says. Whoever knowingly provides material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization, et cetera, et cetera. This second sentence is very important. To violate this paragraph, a person must have knowledge that the organization is a designated terrorist organization, that the organization has engaged or engages in terrorist activity, or has engaged or engages in terrorism. And so with respect to the scienter element, several courts have said, well, look, this is all you have to prove. If your underlying theory is that the bank provided material support to the FTO, Hamas, for example, all you have to prove is that the bank knew that Hamas was a designated terrorist organization, or even if it wasn't aware of the formal designation, you have to prove that it had knowledge that Hamas engages in terrorist activity, as engaged and engages in terrorist activity. Well, the Boehm Court in the Seventh Circuit says no, because this is a statute that authorizes treble damages, and therefore it's punitive. And with respect to punitive torts, they're not simply compensatory. You know, the damages aren't compensatory. Those traditionally, the plaintiffs have had to prove intent, and so therefore we require that there was deliberate wrongdoing on the part of the bank or the charity. So we've got a split there. One last point on the, and I'll stop here and certainly benefit from your comments and questions. Here, again, as I stated, it has to be by reason of. Okay? The Boehm Court at the same time, the Seventh Circuit Court, said that any amount of money is enough to satisfy the causation requirement. And they said basically even $1,000. If you make a $1,000 payment to the Holy Land Foundation, we don't have to trace it. The plaintiff doesn't have to trace it to a particular terrorist attack. But because money is fungible, any amount is enough. So even $1,000 satisfies the causation requirement. In effect, I think that the Seventh Circuit has kind of read out of the statute any meaningful causation requirement. And that is a minority view, and other jurisdictions have required a much closer nexus between the financial services or the collection of money for the charity than has the Seventh Circuit. So in summary, let me just conclude by saying that while I think that Congress's intentions were good, it intended to provide a private cause of action for the victims of international terrorism, I think the statute is a mess. And what are the recommendations? I mean, one of the recommendations is, well, Congress has to fix it. Congress should go ahead and rewrite the statute, plug in scienter, and plug in aiding and abetting if they want the statute to extend to aiding and abetting. Or perhaps maybe the better course is that we rely upon government action rely on the government to address these concerns and not so much leave it to a private cause of action. So I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions you might have. So thank you. Thank you.